Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, June 26, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled From the Courthouse Steps, Wolford v. Lopez, discussing the Supreme Court's most recent Second Amendment decision. My name is Emma Blakemore, and I am an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Amy E. Swearer and John Ohlendorf as our speakers. Mr. Ohlendorf is a partner at Cooper & Kirk, PLLC, and Ms. Swearer is a senior legal fellow at Advancing American Freedom. And I'll leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today, and I will turn things over to Mr. Ohlendorf to start the conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Emma, and good morning to everyone listening. As Emma mentioned, we're here to talk about the court's decision yesterday in Wolford. And I thought I'd begin by just giving a little bit of the background of the case and what the dispute was about. So Wolford involved a challenge to Hawaii's post-Bruin carry regulations. So in the wake of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, which of course struck down New York's May issue carry regime, Hawaii responded by enacting multiple and varied and restrictive limits on public carry, which really is, as Justice Alito's majority opinion yesterday walked through, seemed kind of designed to resurrect a ban on public carry. So they, you know, one thing they enacted was a very onerous licensing requirement for anyone who wanted to carry firearms in public. They also enacted just a suite of sensitive place restrictions, banning people from carrying guns in certain so-called sensitive places, including all government buildings, any restaurant serving alcohol, any fairgrounds, hospitals, or other healthcare facilities, movie theaters, banks, water parks, amusement parks, really just about any place you could imagine. And then third, as particularly relevant here, Hawaii enacted a private property default rule. And that's what this Supreme Court decision was about. So generally, people have what's called an implied license to freely enter private property that's held open to the public. So, you know, think of restaurants, big box stores, gas stations, coffee shops, that kind of thing. You know, privately owned commercial establishments, those are considered open to the public generally. Everybody has an implied license to come on the premises. That's why you can go into a gas station or go out to eat without trespassing and without first asking the property owner's permission to come in. So Hawaii's law, what it did is it flipped that presumption that you can come onto private property, but only for people carrying firearms. So everybody else can continue to have this implied license to enter property open to the public. But if you're carrying a firearm, you first have to get the property owner's express authorization to come in. These you know, they're called private property default laws. Sometimes they're called vampire laws, and you can kind of see why, right? The idea is you have to get permission before you can come inside. A bunch of plaintiffs challenged all of these new post-Bruin restrictions, and the Ninth Circuit, unsurprisingly for, you know, those of you who may have experienced litigating Second Amendment cases in the Ninth Circuit, generally upheld them. And then the plaintiffs sought cert from SCOTUS and got assert, but limited to the private property default rule. So that these other restrictions, including the general sensitive place restrictions, were not at issue in the decision the court handed down yesterday. And so just turning to kind of briefly recap the court's majority opinion, which again was a 6-3 opinion by Justice Alito. I'll walk through that opinion and some of the analysis, and then turn it over to Amy to talk about the separate opinions. So Justice Alito began his opinion really with a very helpful kind of casebook style summary of the Supreme Court's Second Amendment jurisprudence from Heller through Rahimi. There are a couple of notable things about this summary. First, Justice Alito noted, of course, that Bruin established a two-step test, text and history analysis in Second Amendment cases. And he articulated the first, the text step, as comprised of three subparts. He said, first, does the law that's being challenged apply to the people, which is to say all members of the political community, according back to Heller? Second, does it concern any form of arms, i.e. any weapon customarily used for offensive or defensive purposes? And third, does the law place any restrictions on either the keeping, i.e. the possession, or the bearing, i.e. the carrying, of arms? And there are a couple of notable things about this characterization of Heller's text, Bruin's text inquiry. And the most notable one, I think, is that it really emphasizes the narrowness of the inquiry. It's really just looking at the plain meaning of those three words or phrases. And that's a point we'll return to in a moment. Justice Alito then characterized the second, the history step or stage, in a way that's also notable. So again, he kind of broke it down into three subsidiary questions. The first is the number of jurisdictions in which the purported historical analogs were adopted. The second is the extent to which they were well accepted. And the third is whether any analog or collection of analogs is relevantly similar to the law being challenged. Again, it's interesting here, I think, that the court has very clearly reiterated that the historical analogs have to be kind of mainstream, widespread, and well-accepted historical restrictions in order to satisfy the Bruin history stage test. I think that was always implicit in Heller and Bruin, but the court has really kind of underscored it here. And so then, finally, having set forth that framework, Justice Alito really made pretty quick work of Hawaii's private property default rule. Because all the parties had conceded that the petitioners, the plaintiffs in the case, were among the people protected by the Second Amendment and that they sought to bear or carry arms, he concluded, really based on that alone, that the first text stage of the inquiry was satisfied. And the court really dismissed out of hand the argument that Hawaii's law was just a rule of property law that didn't burden the Second Amendment, because that argument was based on what the court called a lengthy discussion of historical materials and precedents. And that meant, the court said, that it belonged at the second history stage, and that it was out of place at Bruin's first step. So again, I think that's a really important, we'll get to the implications of the opinion in a bit, but I think that's a really important feature of the majority opinion, that it has re-emphasized that the first step of the Bruin analysis is a narrow one, than that it's just focused on plain text. Under the second, the history stage of the Bruin analysis, again, the court really pretty quickly dispatched with Hawaii's justification of the law. It said the bulk of Hawaii's historical analogs were just anti-poaching laws. They barred people from carrying arms onto private property for unlawful hunting, and therefore they didn't match either the how or the why under the Bruin framework for analogical reasoning. And then the last law it addressed was one that I think everyone had kind of raised their eyebrows when Hawaii relied on it. It was Louisiana's 1865 Black Code that was unrelated to hunting, and it did appear to forbid people from carrying firearms onto private property without permission. But the court first said, one law is not widespread or widely accepted enough under the Bruin analysis. And then more fundamentally, the court explained, because this was really designed on its face as a tool for disarming blacks, Justice Alito said, unless we put history entirely out of our minds, Hawaii's claim that this tainted artifact illuminates the original understanding of the right to keep and bear arms cannot be taken seriously. So again, really a pretty breezy analysis. The court did not seem to find it very difficult to dispose of Hawaii's historical analogs and struck down the law.
Well, thank you, John, for covering the majority and some of that background. As I go through the dissent and the concurrences here, I'm actually going to start in reverse order from how they're presented in the case itself. So starting with the principal dissent, which was by Justice Jackson, joined by Sotomayor, they start by adopting, if you listen to oral arguments and read the briefs, they adopt Hawaii's primary argument, which is, you know, as John said, that this isn't a Second Amendment case about gun rights at all. It's merely a property case about a law designed to protect the right of exclusion for Hawaii's private property owners. So in the dissent's view, Hawaii's law is not only not an end run around the court's Second Amendment precedents in Bruin, so that Hawaii can issue public carry permits that still afford no real way for Hawaiians to in fact carry guns, but actually it does no harm to the Second Amendment whatsoever. So they stress at this point that Hawaii has this long established local custom of essentially disarming the public and preventing civilians from being disarmed at all. They go all the way back through to the Kingdom of Hawaii and some of their disarmament statutes. So they say, look, there's this local custom that Hawaiians are used to of people being disarmed, much less, you know, not carrying guns in public at all. And so they see this history as an affront. Rather than seeing this history as an affront to the right to keep and bear arms, the dissent sees this as a compelling reason for the state to protect Hawaiian property owners who are just, because of this history, accustomed to people not being armed in public. So basically, because Hawaiians traditionally don't want people armed in public and they aren't used to having to put up no gun signs, the government passed a law to help, as they put it, narrow the informational asymmetry caused by the potential sea change in Hawaii's gun possession rates. So Hawaii is just choosing to protect unaware property owners. And again, as John mentioned, in the dissent's view, this isn't an unconstitutional burden on the right to public carry because there's no constitutional right to enter private property without the owner's permission. So in their view, under Bruin's step one, this really has nothing to do with the plain text of the Second Amendment, and the right to keep and bear arms isn't implicated at all. They also accuse the majority of, as they put it, reconceptualizing Bruin specifically at this first step. And this is something we've seen lower courts do repeatedly in using Bruin's first step to still uphold many of these gun laws, especially in like assault weapons ban cases, is to use a historical analysis at the first step to say, well, this isn't a Second Amendment issue at all. And that's what the dissent wants to do here. Is again, do this historical analysis to say, well, historically, this is about, you know, how property owners must communicate the decision to exclude. And, you know, states historically have the power to set default consent rules and alter the scope of licenses to enter onto private property. And so Hawaii's law doesn't restrict the right to carry guns at all. And we don't have to get into a historical analysis about the right to keep and bear arms. And moreover, you know, they go through a lengthy analysis of how even if this is a Second Amendment case, at Bruin's second step, this is relevantly similar to historical analogs. Hawaii still wins. In short, the dissent would take a much higher level, generalized view of what the how and the why of the historical laws were and how they match with this modern Hawaiian law. So they would say the historical anti-poaching laws weren't worried about the specific harms of unauthorized hunting, but they were more generally about protecting private property like rights of landowners from just the general harms of unauthorized armed carry under their property. And you know, that's exactly what Hawaii's law does. And then finally, there's, I think, an important final part of the Jackson dissent is her analysis of the Black Codes of this 1865 Louisiana statute. Which seems to, she doesn't quite go so far as to to get quite there, but it does seem to lean toward rejecting the contention from the majority that the again, admittedly racist Reconstruction laws shouldn't ever be used in history and tradition analysis. And she says, well, maybe it's the case that these laws violate the Second Amendment, but maybe it's the case that these laws didn't violate the Second Amendment because of their restrictions on bearing arms, but that only the only violation was in the 14th Amendment because they were discriminatory. And she accuses the majority of just bypassing this historical analysis, where, you know, in her view, it might just be the case that they were unconstitutional because they were discriminatory and racist, and that's why we can't rely on them. But we can still use this as part of the Second Amendment analysis to see the scope of the right to keep and bear arms if we take away that racial component. Then you have the Kagan dissent, and she dissents on her own. I think this is important because we once again see Kagan distancing herself from Jackson and Sotomayor in a Second Amendment case. We just saw this in Hamani, the other Second Amendment case that came out last week, where she doesn't join Jackson and Sotomayor in Hamani as attacking Bruin as wrongly decided. And instead, she joins Alito's concurrence, which just purported to decide that case on, I think, narrower grounds, but it's still not clear to me how their concurrence differed from the majority in Hamani. So Kagan's dissent, it's less than two pages. Clearly, she wanted nothing to do with the principal dissent's property argument, doesn't want to touch the Black Codes argument with them. But she does essentially just agree with their analysis of the historical analog issue. As she points to part three of the Jackson dissent to basically say, yeah, that's the historical analysis that I mean here. But again, she doesn't join that dissent. And she does indicate that it's because you know, she thinks the historical analog test resolves the issue, and she doesn't want to get into Bruin's one-step inquiry or the use of the Black Codes in Bruin's step two. And then finally, you have the Barrett concurrence. Now, this is interesting to me because in many respects, it reads like the majority opinion. It's joined by Gorsuch and Thomas with respect to part of part two. But when you go through it, I mean, it reads very similarly to Alito's majority. She does start with a lengthy critique of the principal dissent's argument that this isn't a Second Amendment issue at all, that it's a property law issue. And she does, I think, get more in depth in that than Alito does, for sure. And she also does a good job, I think, of articulating how the dissent gets Bruin step one wrong in a way that's not necessarily different, in my opinion, from what Alito does, but I think does go perhaps a little bit more in depth. And again, in much the same manner as Alito's majority opinion, she goes into an analysis of the how and why of the historical laws. You know, she says, for example, today the right to bear arms is misused in other ways that were unknown to our forebears, but pose an equivalent risk to persons and property. And this is where this part, I think, gets a little bit more into the question of how does this relate to laws about sensitive places? She says the anti-poaching laws support the principle that when a state identifies specific places that are prone to particular abuses of the right, it can respond with, quote, focused regulations to address the threat. So the problem with Hawaii's default rule is not that it targets a regulatory problem besides poaching. It's that the rule does not target any particular abuse of firearms at all. So basically, rather than Hawaii identifying some sort of specific threat to public peace and safety, Hawaii just said, well, our citizens oppose the public carry of guns. We're responding to a general danger and not to any specific heightened misuse. And they applied it to all private property, you know, as John said, from the hardware store to the gas station to fast food restaurants. And so in her view, you know, again, these 18th century hunting regulations can't support that rule. And the mere disapproval of protected conduct is not a valid reason to severely restrict it. She also goes pretty in depth, pushing back on Justice Jackson's assessment of this 1865 Louisiana statute. There is a theory, you know, because again, you sort of read this concurrence and pair it with Alito's majority, and it's sort of this question of what is the difference here. And I think You know, Josh Blackman has a pretty good theory that perhaps Barrett was initially assigned the majority, but lost it. And that's why it almost to some extent reads very much like that majority opinion. One thing I do want to mention, because it is rather curious, is that the majority opinion doesn't mention Hamani at all. And Barrett's concurrence only mentions it in passing. And this is a bit strange because Hamani was a basically unanimous case that just came out on very much the same issue, the same analysis. And there also seemed to be ample opportunity for especially Alito to wield Hamani as a club with which to thump the dissent on its head, because they all just joined the Hamani majority. And I think this is particularly notable with respect to because Kagan had joined, again, Alito's concurrence in Hamani. And that concurrence, if you read it, it says, well, to succeed in Hamani, the government would need to justify a regulatory principle that justifies the disarmament of persons who are relevantly similar to the occasional marijuana user. They said, well, the government's analogs allow disarmament only to those whose extreme use of an intoxicant incapacitated them habitually, as applied to a respondent who allows disarmament of those who do no more than regularly use a similar intoxicant unlawfully. And it's strange to me that Alito, of all people, doesn't wield this against Kagan, because in Wolford, she sort of takes a very different approach and says, well, the why is sufficiently close here because both sets of laws just respond to harms and dangers about, you know, someone with a gun on another person's property. And so she seems to take two very different approaches in these cases to how broad that how and why have to be. So again, just curious to me that this never gets brought up. So John, as a litigator in this space, I'm going to pass it to you with what I think is a very important question. What are some of the main ways in which we can expect Wolford to impact Second Amendment challenges going forward?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. So I think the most important one we don't know yet, which is, you know, we had two Second Amendment cases this term on the court, two big wins. The main question, I think, for Second Amendment litigation is that trend going to continue? Are we going to see the court continue to grant, you know, one or two Supreme Court cases a term and decide them? Because it's clear before Bruin, there was massive resistance to Heller among the lower courts. There continues to be very, very powerful resistance to the Supreme Court's Second Amendment jurisprudence. So, you know, I've long thought the main thing that preserves the Second Amendment is just a series of very clear Supreme Court majority opinions, just kind of resolving the main disputed issues. Because I just don't think that the lower courts can really be counted on in this situation. And we don't know yet, you know, what is the court going to do in the wake of these cases? It has a bunch of petitions pending. Presumably it's going to GVR some of them. Is it going to grant some of them? We just don't know yet. But fingers crossed that this portends kind of a more active role in Second Amendment jurisprudence for the court. For lower court litigation, I think really there's general and specific implications, right? Generally, I think the most important part, perhaps, of the decision is the court's discussion of the plain text step. As Amy mentioned, this was really something that sort of unfriendly states and lower courts had seized on. They had tried to really smuggle as much of the historical reasoning process as possible into the plain text step, where the government doesn't bear the burden. And we're really, you know, consulting all kinds of historical materials and analogs to try to say that, for example, assault weapons aren't arms based on some historical principle that has, you know, it's fraudulent to begin with, but has nothing to do with the plain meaning of the word arms, right? Hopefully the court has now been clear enough about this that the lower courts will get the hint that the plain text inquiry really is just a plain text inquiry. To me, this was clear from Heller and clear from McDonald and clear from Bruin, crystal clear in Bruin. You know, there are good, reasonable arguments on both sides of a lot of Second Amendment issues. This idea that you can smuggle the history into the first plain text step has never struck me as one of them. It just seems just a really kind of a bad faith reading of Bruin. So hopefully the court's opinion puts that to bed. Then more specifically, and this gets into to some of the questions that have been posed in the Q&A, I think the case does have, you know, implications for, you know, what is now the ongoing litigation over sensitive places restrictions. And I think, you know, I think there are a lot of passages in Alito's opinion that are friendly, that are friendly to those challenges. I think this, you know, this passage that Amy singled out from Justice Barrett's concurrence could be read in a way that's maybe less friendly to some of those challenges. But I think the court has yet to really tip its hat on how it views the sensitive places doctrine, if you want to call it that, outside of, you know, the brief discussion in Bruin rejecting New York's argument that the entire island of Manhattan was a sensitive place. So it appears that maybe there's some internal debate among the conservatives on the court on that issue, or that, you know, they just haven't really had to tackle it. I think that's one explanation for why Barrett writes separately on this, is that, you know, the rest of the conservatives just didn't want to, you know, say anything that was going to prejudice challenges to sensitive places restrictions down the road. But again, I think there are passages that are friendly to those restrictions, and, you know, hopefully the court will take up one of these cases soon and provide some more guidance.
Yeah, I tend to agree that perhaps, because this isn't the first time that we've seen some of these more gun control friendly, perhaps, statements be thrown in. We saw it even in Bruin with some of the footnotes and some of the concurrences where they, even in Helmani, right? We're not drawing any conclusions as to how this applies outside of this narrow specific set of circumstances, while still, again, the broader principles would seem to suggest that they have some problems once they actually have to use that test to analyze those specific situations that they left open. So perhaps that's a charitable way of putting it, is that they don't want to prejudice some of those issues going forward that, you know, might fall closer to those gray areas that are less clear cut. And I think realistically, just the way that some of these lower courts, the less friendly lower courts, have responded to Bruin, and to, you know, just Heller and McDonald, I don't think they necessarily needed those statements in order to, you know, continue in the Ninth Circuit's case, rarely finding gun control laws that aren't perfectly compatible with the Constitution. But I do think they will likely pounce on those and try to use as broad of a conception, in some of these ongoing cases to uphold these laws. So again, I don't think they needed that, but I think we absolutely will see them use that even beyond, I think, what the Supreme Court would anticipate that being used to protect some of these statutes. And I think John's right. At the end of the day, I think you're going to see, from a policy standpoint, I don't think Hawaii is just going to roll over. I think they're going to continue to pass laws that are going to lead to very similar litigation that'll be slightly different, but really the same issue. And until the Supreme Court really steps in and continues building on this jurisprudence, continues demonstrating how the Bruin test works in practice, these issues are going to remain open, at least in the sense of lower courts continuing to uphold these regulations until the Supreme Court steps in.
Yeah, 100%. So we're almost at time. We don't have a lot of time for questions. I think we've kind of addressed most of the questions that came up. There is one that I did want to mention. Somebody had mentioned, Hawaii's argument that the spirit of aloha justifies their restriction. And I found that interesting that either Alito several times or both Alito and Barrett kind of dunked on that argument. I don't think Hawaii had really argued that in this case. That line was from this Hawaii Supreme Court, I think in the Wilson case decision that, and I think cert was sought in that case and it wasn't a good vehicle and the court didn't take it up. But it's really interesting that they kind of dunked on that several times. I almost kind of saw that as the conservatives on the court kind of taking the opportunity to repudiate that decision in this kind of sideways way because they didn't have a chance to grant cert on it. But so I found that kind of amusing.
One thing I will say on this, the Supreme Court of Hawaii's very, very limited defense. If you look at that opinion and you look at that sentence, there is in fact a footnote regarding the spirit of aloha. Hawaii does in fact have a statute giving local and state officials the ability and in fact command to interpret things according to the spirit of aloha, which is very specifically defined. So limited defense, they didn't completely make that up, but it is still an absurd argument.
Okay, well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating today. We also welcome feedback from listeners by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.